From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Florida voters overwhelmingly supported expanding the state's medical marijuana laws last November when more than 70% of voters said yes to Amendment 2. But lawmakers are pushing major changes as it now becomes a law. Today, we'll speak with one of the authors of Amendment 2 about those changes, and we'll speak to a political scientist about how and why amendments change as they make their way from the ballot box to the law books. Plus, we've seen some big changes for Florida wildlife. Manatees are no longer endangered, panther kittens have been spotted north of the Caloosahatchee River, and the burrowing owl is now considered threatened by the state of Florida. We'll talk with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, the Western Everglades Audubon, and the Save the Manatees group about what's next for these three iconic Southwest Florida species. First, the news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Whether you're from Florida or not, the iconic symbols of our state's delicate balance between development and nature is the list of animals with environmental protection because their species is dwindling in numbers. This week, we had news about three of these species, the manatee, the Florida panther, and the burrowing owl. The news on each has been met with some celebration, cautious optimism, and some serious pushback from at least one group, and we're going to talk about each of those in this half hour. The beloved slow-moving herbivore sea cow, the manatee, was listed endangered back in 1967. Now it's been delisted and is considered threatened under the Endangered Species Preservation Act of 1966. At first blush, it appears to be a victory for the manatee, but Ann Harvey Holbrook, the staff attorney for Save the Manatees, says not so much. She joins us to talk about the manatee's downlisting and possible threats to progress that has already been made. Thank you for joining us, Ann.
Glad to be here.
The Florida panther has rebounded ever so slightly from the brink of extinction, too, and while it's still endangered, we have the first confirmed litter of kittens north of the Caloosahatchee in decades. Amber Crooks with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida is here to talk about when, if ever, this big cat will be out of the woods. Thank you so much for being here.
Good afternoon.
Also recently, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission listed the burrowing owl as threatened. It's been protected under the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act for years, but what does this mean to a landowner who wants to build on land where the pint-sized ground-dwelling owls have made their home? Brad Cornell with the Audubon of Western Everglades is here to help sort that out. Thanks so much for coming in.
Glad to be here.
We are talking about owls, manatees, and panthers this half hour with updates on each of the dangers that these species face. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So, Ann Harvey Holbrook with Save the Manatees. Some would see the removal of the manatee from the endangered list as a victory, as if the Save the Manatees group had achieved its goal, but that's not how the organization is seeing this. Can you tell me why?
Yeah, absolutely. Save the Manatee Club has worked for a long time towards the downlisting of manatees and the eventual day when they can be delisted. Unfortunately, that is not now. The rule, we believe, was not made on the best available science. The data doesn't consider the most recent threats to manatees from harmful algal blooms and cold stress in recent years, and doesn't consider the threats that manatees face in their habitats, the loss of artificial and natural warm water refuges that they depend on in the wintertime.
Well, this has been kind of a while in the making. I read the ruling from the Department of the Interior, and it looks like a lot of years went into making this decision. They had a number of studies, but does your organization feel like they're looking at old data?
Yes, they are looking at old data, and we have not had an opportunity to review the most up-to-date data that the service says that they're relying on. But this rule was initiated in response to a lawsuit brought by an anti-regulatory group called Pacific Legal Foundation, representing a local group called Save Crystal River. And then it's part of an overall scheme that they're working on to remove Endangered Species Act protections nationally.
So there was
so that's what initiated the Fish and Wildlife Service's response here.
So there was external pressure to delist them, you're saying?
That's correct.
And that came from who, again?
The Pacific Legal Foundation, representing Save Crystal River, brought a lawsuit to initiate downlisting.
So now that they're downlisted, what is going to happen to these federal protections? Do they change at all?
The federal protections don't immediately change under a threatened listing, but the concern is that the majority of manatee protections are actually derived through state processes. For example, all the seed zone protections in Florida's waterways are done at the state level. So this creates a slippery slope through the perception that manatees are doing well, that protections aren't needed, and those protections are already seeing instances where efforts are being made to roll them back, and it will certainly reduce incentive for any needed protections in the future.
So your point is that federal protections or the federal listing could have an impact on decisions at the state level with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and kind of skewing perception.
That's correct. And once the manatee has been downlisted to threatened, you know, should the population numbers decline again because these threats are ongoing and increasing throughout their range, including in Florida, it's much harder to have them, it may be harder to have them relisted, for example. And so these protections are just being eroded one by one, and we're concerned that it just creates a process by which eventually manatees, we've worked so hard for the progress that's been made so far, and we don't want that hard work to be undone.
Now, is there a possibility, if they do roll back all the, some of the larger protections that are there, how quickly would you see an impact from that, do you think? I mean, it's kind of hard to predict the future, but I mean, how impactful would that be immediately?
I mean, I think that depends on the protections that may be undermined, but 2016 was a record year for watercraft mortality for manatees. So even with the protections in place, we're already seeing continued impacts from these threats. So I imagine you would see them fairly immediately, although it may not have disastrous impacts right away. I just can't predict what other factors might go into it.
Yeah, that would be a tough one. So what is next then for Save the Manatees? Are you going to try to have them relisted as endangered, or are you going to work on other avenues to try to keep the state protections in place?
We're reviewing our options with regard to the federal rule, and, of course, we'll continue to work to maintain state protections. We just want what's best for the species, so we're going to look carefully at that.
All right. And I want to shift now to the Florida Panther with Amber Crooks with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. There are two kittens north of the Caloosahatchee, so do you cheer when you hear news like this?
Of course we do. Yes, it's the first time since the 70s that we've had breeding female north of the Caloosahatchee River. And we also heard last week that there may be more females than we had heard previously north of the Caloosahatchee.
Wow, because I remember just a couple months ago We were all excited when we saw the one.
That's right. Now we know that she has at least two kittens, and then there's also some evidence of some mating behavior over in the Fish Eating Creek area. So that's north of the Caloosahatchee as well.
Is there any kind of predictive equation you guys do to know how this family could grow further north?
Well, we were hoping when we first heard the news of the female that she would successfully breed. And so we're hoping to continue to protect her habitat north of the Caloosahatchee, as well as the corridors and connections that other panthers, male and female, will need to also join them north of the Caloosahatchee River.
So I'm wondering how they got over there. I mean, you're going to tell me they swim. Are they big swimmers? Because cats generally don't like water.
Well, we do have evidence that the panther can swim, just like bears and other wildlife. So for many decades, males did not see the Caloosahatchee as a barrier. There are some areas amongst the Caloosahatchee where it was just narrow enough that they would make that leap and swim across. And now we do have confirmation that females are following in those tracks.
Can you just even imagine if you were driving along in a boat and you saw a panther crossing the river? So tell me a little bit about the numbers now. Where do they stand right now with panthers?
Well, just recently, amongst this other good news, there was a new population figure that was announced as well. The new population is estimated at 120 to 230 panthers, and that, I will say, is science's best guess. It's very difficult to count these panthers, so sort of a cautionary note that it's their best guess, but it does show that the population is increasing.
Mm-hmm. They're becoming more visible. Just as their population is increasing, there's a greater number of them getting hit by cars.
Well, that is certainly a factor to the deaths that we are seeing. I think another factor, though, too, is that we're having more folks on the road. The Conservancy calculated just over a five-year span in Lee and Collier counties that there was about 3 million more vehicle trips. So although the expanding population is one factor, I think also they've got to look at the traffic and the roadways and the loss of habitat. That's another factor.
So it's like there are a few more targets, but a few million more arrows, right?
That's a good analogy.
Okay. So how many miles does a panther need? Like you said, it's kind of hard mm-hmm. to track them and hard to figure out exactly how many there are because they do have a pretty large range. Can you tell me what that range is?
Yes, they do. Females are about 75 square miles. Males could be, you know, about 200 square miles, give or take. But they home range do overlap. But we are talking about an expansive habitat base that's needed to be sustained. So while we're cheering this good news, the expansive population and the breeding north of the Caloosahatchee, we're also having to sort of keep our mind on the goal, which is to continue to expand the population. The recovery criteria are three populations of 240 cats each, which would mean sustaining the habitat that we have here in Southwest Florida, as well as protecting habitat throughout the state and perhaps into other states as well.
Yeah, and you're going to have to do a lot, I think, as far as education, as far as cohabitation, because there are a lot of people here.
Mm-hmm. And that would be the third thing. So we've got protecting the habitat, making sure we have the connection and corridors. And the third is education and outreach to make sure people are aware of the nature that's here.
And considering that they need that much space, I think getting north of the river, I mean, there's not that much space south of the Caloosahatchee.
That is one thing that we're finding is that we are continuing to lose habitat here in Southwest Florida, perhaps tens of thousands of acres of the prime panther habitat area over the last few years even.
So I have a question for you. We were just talking about the manatee and about how it's no longer considered endangered. If the panthers, and I'm talking a little while in the future mm-hmm. here, if they were to achieve the status where they are no longer considered endangered and they're just threatened and some of these federal protections went away, would you have similar fears?
Well, I think would be similar here is that the Conservancy would look at the information that was used to make those decisions and make sure that it was solid using the best available information. So, you know, if that was the case, you know, it would obviously defer to the best information.
But, I mean, if all these protections were taken away, all the protections that are in place right now, if they were taken away, what do you think would happen at that point to the population mm-hmm. of panthers?
Well, we wouldn't, of course, want it to be deregulated and delisted until we knew that the population was secure and could withstand the normal threats that the panther is experiencing on a year-to-year basis from habitat loss, which is going to continue into the future, from vehicle mortalities, and that we knew, you know, its population was secure into the future.
Yeah. And now I'm going to make another pivot to the burrowing owl. This is the only owl that nests in the ground. It's protected by the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and now the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission has listed it as threatened. And we have Brad Cornell with the Audubon of the Western Everglades and Audubon, Florida. Tell me a little bit about these owls.
Well, they're a native Florida species, and normally when people think of burrowing owls, they think of the Southwest, where their cousins use prairie dog holes and burrows for their homes. But here in Florida, they dig their own burrows, and they're a sort of a keystone species because lots of other critters like their burrows. And they're charismatic, about 9 inches tall, and we have some of the biggest populations here in Southwest Florida on Cape Coral and Marco Island, the two biggest populations in the state of Florida.
Yeah, I think it's the official bird of Cape Coral. Like, I mean, that's on their website.
Rightfully so. And what's happened, it's normally an interior Florida bird, like on ranch lands and open grass prairies, but we've created some wonderful burrowing owl habitat on some of these coastal areas that we've dredged and piled up a whole lot of sand, which to them looks like a nice ridge in
yeah.
a prairie. Yep. So they are very happy digging holes in there.
So what's been the general response to the state's listing of these animals as threatened?
Well, it's an appropriate listing because their habitat is uplands and we build our homes and communities in uplands. There's an immediate conflict. So and when anybody who lives near these owls, almost everybody wants to see them survive and sustain themselves. Everybody, they're so charismatic, everyone loves them. But we've got to figure out some way of sharing the space. That's kind of a common theme with wildlife, mm-hmm. including imperiled wildlife. How do we share that space? We have the unfortunate fact that Audubon has received at least 5 reports in the last month of people filling in burrows, either putting rocks in that happened last week or filling it in with sand or just in the dead of night because they fear that the owls are not going to prevent them from building their house or selling their lot. And this just isn't true. And it's really important that everybody understands that you just need a permit. You need to go to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission to get a permit to build your house and to sell your lot outside of nesting season. And that's all it takes.
This is a critical time right now, though, for these owls.
Correct. This is nesting season. From February to July is nesting season for them. They're laying eggs. They're making babies. And it's an amazing thing to see. We have about 35 monitors, volunteer monitors, that we've trained on Marco Island in a program that was started by Marco Island City's natural resource manager, Nancy Ritchie, and has been taken over by Audubon of the Western Everglades and Gene Hall. And it's an amazing thing to see. We just want to make sure that everybody understands what it takes to keep those owls on Marco Island and in Cape Coral. And that's that understanding.
Well, we do have a caller on the line. It's Bob from Tampa, and he's been very patient. But I wanted to wait until we got to the owl section before we had you talk, because I think you wanted to say something about the nest removal. Bob?
Yeah, I understand when landowners say, hey, you know, I have a list of species on my property and it's going to cost me something. But with regards to the migratory bird removal permit, there is no fee for that permit. So, I mean, you need a fee for a fishing license in Florida, a hunting license for a state listed, when they were a state issued species special concern, and now they're a threatened species. There is no fee for the permit. So that's one thing. So if there was a fee, I mean, even $5, $10, they could use the money to study, to put it towards studying burrowing owls. And then the other question regarding the migratory bird nest removal permit, all they make you do is survey outside of the nesting season. If the burrow's empty, they make you can collapse the burrow, make a new burrow somewhere else, and put up a key purchase that's to try to lure the owls. But again, there are no studies to even prove that this works. So there's no studies collectively done statewide to say, okay, if you impact these birds and you put up a starter perch and you dig a starter burrow, that these owls are going to use it. So, I mean, landowners don't pay anything, and then the state really does no research to see if these mitigation options work. So, I mean, I don't really know what the complaint is regarding landowners with the permits.
Yeah, the inconvenience, I guess, and the bureaucracy and having to deal with that.
And I think people just haven't really thought it through. They think of like the snail darter stopping a whole big dam in the Tennessee Valley Authority or something like that, and it's just not that case. There is every opportunity to work it out with the FWC to get a permit to move the owls outside of nesting season. Is it a hassle? Yes, it's more of a hassle than if they weren't there, but it's the cost of doing business in Florida, and in the end, I think everybody will be happy.
Well, the greater hassle is going to jail. Because when you mess with a burrowing owl's nest in nesting season, you can face up to $15,000 in fines per egg or per baby, per chick. So it can get pretty expensive, and you can also face jail time if you're disturbing nests that are being used during nesting season. I actually called the federal agency that handles the permitting in relation to Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and they said that an active nest is never going to be able to get moved. You cannot move it if it's active. And it's only active during the nesting season. And as you mentioned, that's from February to July. And after July 10th, if it's empty, you can collapse it and you can use it. And that's just on the federal level. However, once you get through those federal loops, then you have to go to the state loops, and then you have the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and then they need to verify and give you a permit. So that's how that works. And you can also build around a burrow if they're like in your front yard or your backyard. You just have to give them, I think it's 10 or 20 feet.
It varies, and our advice to anybody who asks us is to check with the experts, the biologists and law enforcement folks at FWC, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. They have local staff, and they're the experts on how to do this. This is a new listing. This just happened in November, so everybody's sort of realigning themselves with the new requirements, but they have assured, in talking with their staff, they have assured us all that there is still a process. You can still build on your lot. You can still sell your lot. That no one should feel like they need to, in the dead of night, fill in a burrow and possibly kill the babies or the adults.
Or get busted, because, as you said,
people
love watching these guys, so they'll see you doing that. I mean, the neighbors are going to be
watching them.
The
neighbors love them. They're watching out their windows and taking pictures.
They'll turn you in.
Don't think they won't. In fact, that's how we found out. We found out from neighbors and our own monitors who said, hey, somebody's out there kicking in the sand into this burrow, or I walked by this with my dog and there's rocks in the thing. What's going on here?
Yeah.
So there are investigations currently ongoing, but we don't want to get to that point. We just want everybody to understand that everybody can have a good outcome. You can build your house and keep the owls intact.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are running out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there for now. But I do want to thank our guest, Brad Cornell, with the Audubon of Western Everglades and the Audubon of Florida. Amber Crooks, the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, thank you both for being here in the studio with me today. And Ann Harvey Hallbrook, staff attorney for Save the Manatees, thanks for being with us on the phone. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith and directed by Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.
They tell me we could drift along the Ossanti, playing in the water with a manatee. Playing in the water with a manatee. Yeah, you and me and a manatee. Swimming down the river near the deep blue sea. Together, how much fun it would be. Playing in the water with a manatee. Playing in the water with a manatee. Playing in the water with a manatee.